This episode features discussion of kidnapping and violence that some people may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13.
On August 12, 2000, 22-year-old professional rock climber Tommy Caldwell, his girlfriend Beth, and their friends Jason and John were captured by members of the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, or IMU.
As the rebels rifled through their belongings, fellow prisoner Tarat tried to warn Tommy through gestures. He dramatically pointed to his bloody clothes, held up three fingers, and made a throat-slitting gesture with his hand.
Tommy panicked, thinking their captors were going to kill the three American men and disappear with Beth into the countryside.
But Tarat quickly recognized the terror in Tommy's eyes and cried, "Niet, niet, no, no." He continued gesturing until he was able to make his story clear.
Tarat, who was a sergeant in the Kyrgyz army, had been captured along with two other soldiers by the IMU militants. His comrades were then brutally murdered, but Tarat had been kept alive solely for the purpose of helping locate the Americans.
Tarat rolled his fingers together, making the universal sign for money. Tommy and his friends immediately understood. They would be kept alive and held for ransom.
Tarat explained that there were several Kyrgyz soldiers in the valley nearby, but there were also more IMU rebels. Soon, there would be fighting.
Tommy's heart sank as he realized the two outcomes. They would either be held for ransom,
or they would die in the crossfire.
This is Hostage, a Parcast original. Every week, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in kidnapping situations and what the human brain does when held captive.
I'm Irma Blanco.
And I'm Carter Roy.
You can find episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Hostage for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Hostage in the search bar.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
This is our second episode about the kidnapping of 22-year-old professional rock climber Tommy Caldwell, his girlfriend Beth Rodden, and their friends Jason Singer Smith and John Dickey.
On August 12, 2000, the four climbers were exploring the Karasu Valley region in southern Kyrgyzstan when they were taken hostage by Salafi jihadist militants known as the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan.
Last week, we learned about the early days and motivation of the Al-Qaeda-affiliated IMU. We also got to know professional rock climber Tommy Caldwell and experienced the first chilling moments of his group's kidnapping.
This week, we'll follow the four hostages as they endure six harrowing days of captivity. We'll see how they use their instincts to survive under grueling conditions, and we'll find out what Tommy was forced to do to secure their eventual escape.
On August 9th, 2000, 28 members of the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan slipped into southern Kyrgyzstan by way of high mountain passes. They ambushed and tortured Kyrgyz soldiers, interrogating them about local military forces and the presence of foreigners.
The IMU had successfully ransomed outsiders in the past, and they used the money to help fund their activities. Now, they were hoping to repeat this method by kidnapping foreign tourists in Kyrgyzstan's beautiful southern region, also known as the Yosemite of Central Asia.
As the IMU continued to ambush more Kyrgyz soldiers in the area, they gradually extracted more information. They learned that there was a larger Kyrgyz army outpost in the area, and that groups of German, Ukrainian, and American rock climbers had been spotted nearby.
So on August 10th, the IMU rebels split into two groups. One set out to ambush the army outpost. The other party, led by an Uzbeki rebel named Abdul, set out to find the valuable foreigners.
Abdul's group brought with them Turat, a captured Kyrgyz soldier who had seen four American climbers days before and knew where to find them.
The next day, on August 11th, two of Abdul's comrades, named Obid and Sue, kept an eye on the Americans from a distance. They watched as 22-year-old professional rock climber Tommy Caldwell and his three friends packed up their base camp. They were preparing for an overnight climb on a route known as the Yellow Wall.
But the rebels didn't pounce yet. Instead, they waited to strike until the rock climbers were already on the Yellow Wall. On the morning of August 12th, Tommy Caldwell, his 20-year-old girlfriend Beth Rodden, and their friends, 22-year-old Jason Singer Smith and 25-year-old John Dickey, woke to the sound of gunshots. They peered out of their tents to see the IMU rebels standing on the ground.
The rebels forced the four Americans to descend the Yellow Wall. Then Tommy and his friends were taken back to their own base camp, which the three rebels had already begun to pilfer, taking food, clothes, and two-way radios.
There they met Turat, the Kyrgyz soldier who had been taken captive and who Tommy and Beth had just met a few days prior.
Over the next hour, Turat made it clear to the Americans the danger of their situation. They were being kidnapped and kept alive for ransom, provided they could make it safely through a battle between the IMU rebels and Kyrgyz soldiers.
Abdul and his men instructed the four captives and Turat to fill their backpacks with whatever food and clothing was left. Then they were told to tear down what was left of the base camp and hide any remnants beneath rocks and pine needles.
As the hostages obeyed, one of Abdul's men, Sue, patrolled the area using the stolen radios. Suddenly, Sue sent a report to Abdul at the camp. Abdul shouted at everyone, gesturing for them to dive into the trees and hide.
Peeking out from their hiding place, the captives saw a military helicopter circle the area. It hovered at the Yellow Wall, then flew away.
Tommy hoped the pilot had seen their abandoned portaledges and that he would report the incident, but even if he did, how long would it take for help to arrive?
As soon as the helicopter was gone, Abdul ordered them to leave the area. Over the next few hours, the four Americans, Turat, and their three armed kidnappers began a long march north.
The journey was immediately arduous. The mountain terrain was steep and treacherous, and the heavy backpacks they were forced to carry made hiking all the more difficult.
As they went, Tommy and his three friends glanced at each other. Worry was written all across their faces.
They had no idea where they were going or if they would even make it there alive.
Abdul, who was clearly the leader of the rebels, occasionally ordered the group to halt and hide from nearby Kyrgyz patrols and overhead helicopters, threatening to use it if anyone tried to get the soldiers' attention.
Given the frequency of these sightings, it seemed like the earlier helicopter had reported the climbers' empty portaledges. Or at least that's what Tommy hoped, but the rebels were keeping too close an eye on his group for any of them to signal for help.
Throughout the day, Turat made it clear to Tommy, Jason, and John that he wanted to overpower their captors as soon as they had a chance. He wanted the Americans to help him, but Tommy and his friends were reticent to agree.
They reasoned that the military already knew there was trouble. Surely this meant they'd be rescued soon. Besides, their kidnappers were heavily armed. Wasn't it safer to wait than to risk being shot at?
But this was precisely the sort of danger they were walking into. By mid-afternoon, the group of eight emerged on a hillside and crossed a nearby river to meet up with more rebels. Nearby, Kyrgyz soldiers were asking shepherds about the group of rebels and the foreigners traveling with them. Tommy realized it was the deadly confrontation between the Kyrgyz army and IMU rebels that Turat had predicted.
The soldiers were growing closer, so the four IMU rebels dragged their hostages up the rocky hill and told everyone to hide behind trees and boulders.
The Kyrgyz soldiers took up positions across the river behind buildings and rocks. After a brief while, they heard three soldiers walking across the river's bridge in their direction. Abdul gave the order to shoot.
The captives considered running, but with so much gunfire, they knew they'd be hit. They squeezed behind their hideouts for safety.
Tommy and his girlfriend Beth were huddled together with Tarat, bullets flying all around them, when Abdul rushed over. He grabbed Tarat and solemnly led the Kyrgyz soldier up the hill and behind a boulder.
Almost immediately, two clear shots rang out.
Tarat, their only friend in the situation and the only one who spoke the same language as their captors, was dead.
He had served his purpose in helping to find the Americans and was no longer useful to the IMU.
Meanwhile, the nearby Kyrgyz soldiers were closing in. There was no time for the climbers to mourn Tarat or consider how his death impacted their situation. Just then, Abdul rounded the boulder where he had shot Tarat. He screamed for everyone to join him behind it.
John made a dash for it first. As he ran, the incoming bullets hit his enormous backpack, sparing him from almost certain death. Jason ran next, then Tommy.
When Jason arrived, he was horrified by the sight of Tarat's dead and bloodied body. But there was no time to think. He waited in angst as Beth made her run.
As Beth rounded the boulder, Jason quickly shielded her eyes from Tarat's body. But the worst was not over. By late afternoon, the battle had escalated into a one-sided assault on their hiding place. Mortars exploded. Another helicopter flew overhead.
Abdul knew it was useless to wait any longer. His valuable captives were no use to him dead, and he needed to get them all out of the area. So he made the decision to abandon their stronghold.
Not wanting to be slowed down by their heavy packs, Abdul ordered the hostages to leave them behind and bring only what they could easily carry and wear. As the sun set, the prisoners ran further up the hill, dodging bullets as they went. Under their captors' watchful eyes, they slipped away from the battle scene and began a long walk into the night.
It was a long journey, and as Tommy and his friends walked, they took stock of what they had brought along. One sleeping bag, a dozen power bars, and a handful of candy.
One of their captors, Obid, was now missing, and Abdullah left during the night for another IMU mission, taking one of the radios with him.
The captives were now under the watchful eye of Abdul and his sidekick, Sue, both of whom seemed agitated and angry. As the hours dragged on, the two men waved their guns and shouted at the hostages, urging them to hurry up.
Tommy looked at the tired and traumatized faces of his friends. They had been on the move for almost a full day and night, and he wondered if the nightmare would ever end.
Coming up, Tommy and the other captives form a plan. Now back to the story.
August 13th, 2000. Around 3 a.m., 22-year-old rock climber Tommy Caldwell, his girlfriend Beth, and their friends Jason and John finally came to a stop. For the past 24 hours, they had been hostages of the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, known as the IMU. They had survived a vicious crossfire before walking all night long under the watchful eye of their main captor, Abdul, and his comrade, Sue.
Now they had arrived at an area with tiny caves where they could hide from the Kyrgyz soldiers. The rebels separated their captives into groups of two and pointed them into caves where they were supposed to rest.
Tommy and his 22-year-old friend, Jason Singer-Smith, were pushed into one cramped cave. Meanwhile, Tommy's girlfriend, 20-year-old Beth Rodden, and another friend, 25-year-old John Dickey, were shown to a different cave.
Tommy felt helpless and angry that he'd been separated from his girlfriend, but he could rely on John to look out for her.
At last, Tommy and the other climbers had a quiet moment to think, and the gravity of their situation sunk in. They were being held at gunpoint and taken to a more remote area in the mountains by terrorist rebels. But why?
Their only friend, a Kyrgyz soldier named Turat, had been brutally murdered the day before. But before his death, Turat had said that the kidnapper's motive was to ransom the Americans to fund their organization, the IMU.
Now, as the hours ticked by, the possibility of being ransomed seemed unsure, and the hope of being rescued felt more remote than ever. Perhaps worst of all, they had no way to deduce what the rebels had planned. Turat had been the only person who could speak their language. Without him, they were completely unable to make sense of the situation.
Hostage specialist Justin Borowski says there are two primary motives for hostage taking: instrumental goals and expressive goals. Instrumental goals have material objects, such as kidnapping for ransom. These tend to be clear-cut. Expressive goals, on the other hand, are more obtuse, and expressive hostage takers tend to be motivated by emotional and personal concerns, such as publicizing their cause. It's more difficult to satisfy these types of goals. Therefore, an expressive hostage situation can be considerably more dangerous than the instrumental one.
Initially, the climbers thought Abdul and his group planned to ransom them as an instrumental goal, but now they weren't so sure. If the goal was ransom, shouldn't the rebels have made contact with the outside world by now, instead of fleeing into more remote parts of the region?
Or had their goals changed? Were the IMU rebels more concerned with publicizing their holy war against Kyrgyzstan and potentially punishing the Americans as an example? But if this was the case, why were they bothering to keep the hostages alive?
The climbers had little knowledge of the IMU group's history of ransom kidnapping, and they weren't sure what to make of the situation. As they lay in their cramped hiding spaces for the rest of the day, each of them mulled over a swirl of questions.
As night fell, the rebels rousted their captives, probing them with guns to get moving. Exhausted, hungry, and confused, Tommy and his friends complied. Before long, they approached a violent river with no bridge. Abdul and Sue tried to move a log over the rapids, but it got stuck.
Jason surprised everyone by stepping in to help. He waded into the dangerous river, wrangled the end of the log, and slowly swam the rest of the way across. Then he held the log in place to let the hostages and their captors cross.
Tommy and the others were confused. Why was Jason helping the kidnappers? But they gradually understood his strategy. Without knowing whether or not they were valued as ransom, they needed to do much more than survive. They needed to show Abdul and Sue how strong and helpful they could be, essentially proving that they were worth keeping alive.
Maybe then they could gain their captors' trust, nudging them to let their guard down. Then maybe, just maybe, they could find a window to escape.
With this shared goal, the hostages tried to be as accommodating as possible. For the next three nights, they marched steadily through the mountainous countryside, prodded on by their captors. They drank sandy brown river water and savored their daily meal, one half of a power bar per person per day.
The uneven terrain was dangerous in the moonlight, and their progress was slow. The four Americans were already weak with fatigue and hunger, and the rebels tormented them by constantly shouting and waving their guns in their faces, telling them to hurry up.
During the day, the group hid wherever they could, usually in cramped overhangs or tiny caves filled with pools of icy water from mountainous runoffs.
Beth was always put with John, and Tommy was always put with Jason. He and Jason spent the long daylight hours resting and confiding in each other about their concerns. It was during these quiet hours that they began to fantasize about escape.
With no end in sight, Jason suggested that they needed to prepare themselves to do whatever it took to survive, even if it meant killing their captors. But for Tommy, this was a particularly brutal thought.
He was a strong, professional athlete, but for as tough as he was, Tommy still had a gentle soul. They struggled with the idea of killing anyone, no matter how bad they were. Instead, he preferred to stick with their original plan of humanizing themselves and thus winning their captors' trust. He hoped they could use this strategy to stay alive while they looked for a chance to escape stealthily and avoid a deadly confrontation.
Over the next few days, the climbers continued to focus on this method. They helped the rebels camouflage their hiding places, assisted in navigating the rocky slopes, and shared personal details like their ages and hometowns. They tried everything they could to build trust and increase their chances for an eventual escape.
Meanwhile, the Kyrgyz government was well aware that there were insurgents in the area. While Tommy's small group was struggling to stay alive in the wilderness, a broader scale of events was unfolding.
Fighting between the soldiers and the IMU rebels had escalated, and the Kyrgyz army was determined to push the rebels out. They didn't hesitate to shoot an unsuspecting IMU rebel, and on August 13th, two of the rebels the climbers had met, Abdullah and Obed, were shot while pausing for a drink at the Karavshin River.
Events intensified the next day. On August 14th, when IMU snipers killed 30 Kyrgyz soldiers. This caused the Kyrgyz army to retaliate in full force, and by August 15th, the majority of the IMU rebels had been surrounded.
But not Tommy's captors. They were still high in the mountains, away from the main action. In the meantime, IMU rebel forces invaded the nearby country of Uzbekistan. Amidst this chaos, General Bolat Yanuzikov of the Kyrgyz Security Council announced that the governments of Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan had agreed to work together to squash the treacherous rebels.
For those in Central Asia and the Middle East, this was a huge unfolding news story, but it hardly made a splash in the United States, where Tommy's family still thought he was enjoying his climbing trip in Central Asia. They had no idea that he and his friends were scrambling for their lives.
By the evening of August 16th, the isolated group of four captives and two rebels had completely run out of food. Abdul used his two-way radio to try and reach his comrade, Abdullah. He wanted to ascertain his location and order Abdullah to bring them food.
Of course, there was no answer. Abdullah was dead. But Abdul and Sue had no idea. Still, they had to make a decision quickly or face dying in the wilderness. So they issued a new set of instructions. Keep walking, but this time, downhill.
The climbers immediately realized they were heading back in the direction of their old base camp, the area where their entire nightmare had begun. But none of them could understand why.
Tommy's mind raced with possibilities. Were they being brought back so that they could be executed? Or was that the place where they would begin making ransom demands? Did Abdul and Sue even have a plan?
In reality, without any contact with the outside world, neither the rebels nor their captives had any idea what was happening elsewhere in the region or what to expect back at base camp. Abdul's immediate concern was finding more food and hopefully meeting back up with his comrades, Abdullah and Obed.
Maybe it was hunger and exhaustion, or maybe their plan was working. Climbers didn't know. But on the 5-mile walk back to base camp, they noticed that their captors were far less vigilant than before.
Instead of guarding them closely from behind, Abdul and Sue walked ahead, looking out for threats. Seeing this change, the hostages considered running, but they knew it wasn't the right time for an escape attempt. They were too weak to outrun bullets and would be dead before any of them made it to safety.
When they finally arrived in the Karasu Valley near their base camp, Abdul signaled that he planned to go ahead and find some soldiers to rob for food. He demanded Jason's coat and left the group hiding along a riverbank with Sue as their guard.
Abdul returned later that night with yak butter and congealed yogurt from a local farmer. The hostages didn't know if he had stolen, killed, or begged for it. They simply accepted what was offered and forced themselves to eat the unfamiliar food. They needed their strength for whatever lay ahead.
On the morning of August 17th, the temperature was near freezing. The climbers were more cold, hungry, and exhausted than they had ever been in their life, and their nerves were far past frayed.
They had lost their ability to speculate what would happen next. All they could think about was survival and escape as they waited for Abdul to give them their next instructions.
When the sun went down, Abdul gestured what he wanted them to do next. His radio was running out of power, and he had apparently hidden extra radio batteries nearby on the day that they had first dismantled the base camp. Abdul's plan was to retrieve the fresh batteries so that he could contact his missing comrade, Abdullah.
In the meantime, Abdul ordered the hostages and Sue to climb a treacherous slope on the west side of the Karasu Valley. He wanted them to reach a plateau 3,000 feet up. This would serve as a meeting point.
After Abdul had retrieved the batteries and made contact with Abdullah, he would catch up with Sue and the hostages on the plateau. Then they would all wait for Abdullah, and possibly Obed, to meet them with food and other refreshments. Once reunited, they would all head north together and cross the border to Uzbekistan.
It was a dismal plan for Tommy and the other hostages. Disappearing into another country would make the chance for eventual rescue even more obscure. And while Abdul did not tell them what was waiting for them in Uzbekistan, they were certain it wasn't going to be good.
Coming up, Tommy makes the hardest decision of his life. Now, back to the story.
On August 17th, 2000, 22-year-old rock climber Tommy Caldwell, his girlfriend Beth Rodden, and their friends Jason Singer-Smith and John Dickey prepared to spend another night trekking through the Karasu Valley. It was their sixth evening as prisoners of the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, and they had been kept under the watchful eye of two rebels, Abdul and Sue.
The leader, Abdul, had just given them orders while he went in search of radio batteries. The starving captives and Sue were to make a 3,000-foot climb to a rendezvous point. Abdul and his two other comrades would meet up with them there, and the entire group would head north to Uzbekistan. What would happen once they got there, Abdul didn't say.
Now, the captives stood shivering in the dark at the foot of the mountain, evaluating their situation. The steep climb would have been easy for the experienced climbers. In their current condition, however, it would be dangerous.
But there was a silver lining to the perilous situation. Abdul would be gone for at least 2 hours retrieving the hidden radio batteries, leaving them guarded by the slightly less menacing Sue. Tommy and the other captives knew that Sue was probably not as experienced a climber as themselves.
For days, the four Americans had been murmuring about whether or not they would be willing to take drastic actions in order to escape, even if it meant murder. Now, it looked like the opportunity might present itself.
Jason was the first one to voice this reality. As he did, a chill ran down Tommy's spine. But they all knew the truth. If they disappeared into Uzbekistan, there was no telling whether they would ever be found. As it were, their families and friends still assumed they were enjoying their original climbing trip.
Uncertain of what would happen, the small party of four mentally prepared themselves for the climb and the possibility of what they might do. Already, Sue looked extremely uncomfortable. He slung his rifle over his shoulder and snapped at Jason to lead the climb.
The group began their ascent. Meanwhile, Tommy's mind was racing at the thought of what they might do to Sue.
According to Dr. Thomas Strenz of the FBI, it is typically unwise to attempt an escape unless the odds of success are extremely high. If a captive does try to escape, their action must be swift and decisive to improve their chances of getting away with it.
As the evening progressed, the odds of escape seemed to be against the hostages. At one point, Jason saw an opportunity to push Sue, but the rebel scooted along to the next handhold before Jason could get into position.
Later in the climb, John reached up to push Sue from below, but again, the rebel slipped out of reach before he could be knocked off the mountain.
By midnight, the group had almost reached the top. Anxious to reach flat ground, Sue climbed faster, rushing ahead to the front of the group. By this point, Tommy was right behind him. He had a better chance than anyone of reaching Sue before the rebel regained control of his gun.
Tommy's heart filled with dread as Sue scrambled up the last ledge. The window of opportunity was closing before his eyes, and he knew it was now or never.
Horrified, Tommy turned to Beth and asked her, "Do you want me to do it?"
Beth was paralyzed by the intensity of the situation and unable to respond, but Tommy took her silence to mean yes. It gave him the permission he needed to do the unthinkable.
Using every ounce of his strength, Tommy launched himself up the wall behind Sue. He grabbed the rifle slung across Sue's back and in one swift movement, pulled the man off the wall.
The other three climbers watched as their captor fell, hitting the side of the cliff before he disappeared into darkness. It all happened so quickly, and yet it seemed to take forever.
Overwhelmed, Tommy finished his climb and fell to his knees. Psychologist R. Scott Stayhower explains that most people don't believe they'd ever be capable of killing another human being. Even when it's clearly self-defense and others are reassuring, the guilt can be extremely difficult to reconcile.
Tommy understood that he had saved his friends and his beloved Beth, but he felt sickened by what he'd done. He broke down in tears, and Beth tried to reassure him. She thanked him for saving their lives and told him she loved him. But Tommy was inconsolable.
Meanwhile, Jason and John told Tommy that he had done the right thing. They suggested that nobody ever needed to know that it had been his responsibility. They could tell everyone back home that they had pushed Sue together. But in the meantime, they had to get moving before Abdul or any other IMU rebels caught up to them.
Fueled by adrenaline, the four climbers fled the scene. They followed a downward incline, trying their best to move quickly and quietly while looking for familiar landmarks. They continued until they eventually found themselves on the bank of the Karvshin River.
Jason and John recognized a nearby trail. They had taken the same path 2 weeks earlier when they went to track down a missing bag from their flight. At the time, it had seemed like a futile journey, but now it gave them clarity as to their surroundings. Jason and John knew beyond a doubt that approximately 10 miles down the trail was a Kyrgyz army outpost.
It was now the wee hours of August 18th, 7 days since they'd been kidnapped, and Jason and John were certain they were getting close to the outpost. As the night wore on, they hurried along, fearing that at any moment an IMU soldier would apprehend them, but they continued undetected.
Finally, just a few hundred feet ahead, they spied a familiar shrine Jason and John recognized. Their eyes lit up, knowing they were less than a mile from the outpost. But the danger wasn't over yet.
Suddenly, three men appeared out of the tree line. One shouted at the four climbers and fired his gun.
The Americans believed that they were being ambushed by rebels and continued to dash towards the shrine.
The three men chased after them, firing shots. Suddenly, more shots rang out in front of the Americans. They were coming from the shrine.
The climbers' hearts sank. Had rebels taken over the shrine?
In the hail of bullets, Tommy and his friends spied a dark figure in the doorway of the shrine, beckoning them forward. They didn't know whether the man was a rebel or a soldier, but with no other choice, they instinctively ran towards the hut for cover.
As they ran, Jason raised his hands in surrender. He screamed, "Amerikansky! Amerikansky!"
Jason dove inside the open door of the hut, followed closely by Tommy, Beth, and John. They collapsed as the strange men frisked them for weapons. Had they made it to freedom? Or was the nightmare about to begin all over again?
But luck was on their side. The men were Kyrgyz soldiers, and as soon as they realized that Tommy and the others were American, their entire attitude changed.
The soldiers explained that the Kyrgyz army had successfully turned back the IMU rebels. The Americans were finally safe.
The Kyrgyz soldiers gave Tommy and his friends food and water, along with fresh army fatigues to replace their tired clothes. Then they were escorted by helicopter to a local town, and later by airplane to the Kyrgyz capital of Bishkek.
During their journey to Bishkek, the U.S. Embassy learned for the first time about their ordeal, and upon arrival, Tommy, Beth, Jason, and John called their stunned families at home, telling them what had happened.
Tommy and Beth took the first flight out of Kyrgyzstan, followed closely by Jason and John, and by late August, all four climbers were back in the U.S., trying to resume their normal lives. But the crush of press attention and the memory of their traumatic ordeal made it difficult.
Shortly after their arrival, fellow climber and journalist Greg Child contacted the group for an interview. They agreed, knowing a member of their climbing community would treat their story with respect, and they told Greg everything, except for one detail.
When it came to Sue's death, they kept their pact, claiming that all three men had pushed him together. But Tommy couldn't handle the guilt. Shortly after the interview, he called the reporter and told him the truth about what had happened, just in time for the article to be revised.
But 1 month later, a new piece of information came forward. Tommy learned that Sue, whose real name was Ravshan Sharipov, had actually survived his fall and been captured.
The information stunned and relieved Tommy. He wasn't a killer after all.
Tommy and Beth were married in 2003. They divorced 7 years later in 2010, but remained friendly.
On January 14th, 2015, 36-year-old Tommy, along with his climbing partner, Kevin Jorgensen, completed the first-ever free climb of Yosemite's Dawn Wall. Beth Rodden was there to cheer them on, and their athletic accomplishment made national headlines, further cementing Tommy's status as an internationally recognized rock climber.
Today, he's a writer, speaker, and survivor. In 2017, he released a memoir called The Push. In it, Tommy recounts his many adventures and lessons learned, including the harrowing experience of being kidnapped. Thanks again for tuning into Hostage. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode.
For more information on the kidnapping of Tommy Caldwell, amongst the many sources we used, we found Over the Edge, the true story of the kidnap and escape of four climbers in Central Asia by Greg Child, extremely helpful to our research.
You can find more episodes of Hostage and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Hostage, for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Hostage on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Hostage in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted.
Hostage was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. Executive producers include Max and Ron Cutler. Sound design by Trent Williamson, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Isabella Way. This episode of Hostage was written by Alex Sloan, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher, and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.